Review, review, review.
Ba 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 bum bum.
Review, review, review.
Ba 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 bum bum.
Review, review, review. Re review, re review.
With me and you. Ba 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 bum. Welcome to our Time to Show Up review episode, where Natalie and I take a deeper dive into last week's interview.
If you hadn't had the chance to listen to that yet, you might want to check it out before listening further here. It'll make a lot more sense that way.
That's right, because in this episode, we will be talking more about the theory behind the material that came up in that interview so we can better understand the elements that were going on there.
We'll also be suggesting reading, practices, and models that may help listeners like yourself who are experiencing resonant challenges and opportunities in their own lives.
In this, our first season of Time to Show Up, we're making all of our content freely available to the public. But in the future, these review episodes will only be available within our subscriber community.
Members of this community will have access to all Time to Show Up content, plus additional resources, materials, access to online forums, live events, and small groups.
Since we know that just listening to stuff isn't usually enough to facilitate desired change, we've designed this community to give you the support you need to take your learning even further. And if you join us at the start of our journey and sign up before April 5th, 2024, we're offering a no-strings, 3-month membership for free at timetoshowup.org.
That's right. And if you choose to stay on with us, which we hope you will, we'll give you a 25% early bird discount just to say thank you. If you're tuning in after that April date, don't worry, you can still try out a free 2-week membership with no obligation. There are different packages to choose from, and you can find out more and get in touch at timetoshowup.org.
So without further ado.
So we're just back from having a very interesting conversation with Oliver Berkman. How was that for you?
Well, I've got to say, I've been wanting to talk to Oliver Berkman for a very long time. So this was really great for me. I don't know when he was doing his column, This Column Will Change Your Life. I used to read it avidly because I think similarly to him, even though I like consider myself a serious mental health,
professional.
There's always been something very attractive about quick fix self-help solutions. And I always really appreciated his evaluation of them. I always thought it was a very steady evaluation. But of course, you get what he's evaluated. You get his words, you get his books, which have been great. So I've always been curious about the man underneath those ideas, what motivated him to seek them. And I really, really just enjoyed that conversation.
Yeah, me too. I particularly appreciated that he gave himself time to reflect and think, because often when we're in these conversations and interviews of any kind, we kind of, well, we've talked about this rush to fill in the silences, and it's lovely to be able to be in conversation where there's room for that and you can go into various different levels. And as you have heard or will hear if you're watching this back to front, which is possible, that there's a lot of touching into paradoxes and how sometimes the routes to self-knowledge and to understanding are quite circuitous. And I think that was quite reassuring in a way, like that many of us take these circuitous routes to getting to a place of knowing ourselves better and then looking backwards and saying, well, I could have just shortcut if. And of course, that's usually not how things work. Mm-hmm. So it was nice to explore that a bit as well.
I also feel like maybe I'm just talking for me, maybe other people, you will identify with this, but I've always had a very ambivalent relationship with the answers, right, that are provided in a lot of these texts. And part of me really hopes that they will provide the answers, but part of me also hopes that they won't.
Because
there's something really scary about the answer. And then, you're accountable to that answer in some kind of a way. So I actually found something quite reassuring about Oliver's historic and continued ambivalence, not only about the answers that come through these texts, but even on a deeper level, why we are producing them in the first place. So this whole movement into productivity and how we manage overstimulation and why and who for and do we need to? Because sometimes we just think, I just need a methodology to fix this, right? Without asking that second question.
And the one point where he talks about sitting on a bench in Brooklyn and realizing that the to-do list that he has, which is constructed for himself based on various tasks, is an impossibility to complete. And that kind of dawning realization in that moment of the absurdity of it,
yes,
and the release that can come from that. And the other theme that I thought was very interesting is that we can have these psychological, conceptual, intellectualized eureka moments frequently, even if we're lucky, but to actually live with them and to integrate them into our mm-hmm. lives. So we're not just having the moment and then forgetting it and then going on as usual. That's quite a lot of practice that can go into that to make it kind of stick. I don't know, it's that paradox of being both reassuring and slightly horrifying that someone who really spends his time exploring these topics still struggles with some of these things, I would suggest probably many, if not all of us do at some point or for long periods of our lives.
Yeah, I mean, again, that idea of like being comforted by, but also like worried about, yeah. right? I think kind of came up and I thought what he expressed really nicely and kind of maybe dismissed as cliche. Mm. And again, I would save that, right? Because if it's cliche, there's something there that we can all plug into. And it's like this core of anxiety that I think everybody has to a certain degree, how much you feel it and how it expresses itself mm. and how kind of almost everything we do in life is a way to manage a core yeah. of anxiety, which might be existential, it might be whatever. And I'm thinking of this book quite old from the 70s by Ernest Becker called The Denial of Death.
The Denial of Death.
Yes. And he was a psychoanalyst. And you know, you probably know that like for Freud, it was all about sex, right? The sex, mm. the libido kind of informs everything, all our defenses, all our drives. And he kind of really took a turn on it and said that actually everything we do, the creative arts, our jobs, all of our distractions mm. are about denying our own mortality. Yeah. And I think there's a lot of truth in there. Mm. And I guess where I'm going with that is I think he was expressing that the core of anxiety and the things that we create in the noise that we create in our lives is exactly the same kind of thing. So it's mm. a denial of a core something that we can't quite put our finger on.
Yeah.
That if only we could better accept that as part of who we are,
yeah.
we wouldn't need to feverishly be finding all of these fixes and cures to everything.
Yeah, and the right? feverish quality of it, I think, is key. It's funny because we didn't get to this point of mentioning this in the conversation, and it's coming up in my mind now, but people who, for instance, have had near-death experiences or are at end of life and they're having, I'm thinking also psychedelic experiences where there is a felt experience of oneness where the rational capacities are put on hold for a while mm. and you get to experience what it is to not have to strive, to not be feverishly busy. And that folks who've experienced these things often, but not always, when the experience abates and they come back into quote unquote normal life, there is a sense that something has shifted mm-hmm. and the feverishness is dropped and put aside, which kind of connects. I mean, it's a different route into one of the things that Oliver talked about, which is making the burden so heavy that you choose to put it down. And the alternative is realizing that the burden in some respects on an existential level is an illusion. Mm-hmm. So there is nothing to put down. So, but you know, these different routes into something where there is an acceptance of a radical nature that then permeates how you live.
Yes. Yes. And there is a subtle thing. So there was that thing where you said, you know, I'm not worried that you just said that all of my work has been a waste of time. Which I promise you, Oliver, was not what I was saying. It's like you have to engage. You always have to engage in it to realize yeah. it, right? That's the kind of fundamental cycle, right? But I'm reminded of this, and again, I'm going to paraphrase it, but the saying that comes out of Zen, which is something like, there's going to get the water, getting the water, seeking the water, carrying the water, and bringing and chopping the wood, or something like that. Then there's Satori, awakening, and then there's getting the water, chopping the wood, and bringing the water, right? Mm-hmm. So the thing that's there before enlightenment in that model is the very thing that's there after enlightenment. Mm-hmm. So it's not like this exciting bliss experience, right? But it's just, you just take the water and chop the wood without all the noise yeah. and junk that comes with it.
Yeah.
And that thing where you can intellectually get that, but not really, it's so difficult to let
that. To bring it into your body.
Yes. Mm-hmm. That just pick up the water, answer the email, not finish the job.
And yeah.
go to bed and wake up the next day.
But I think it's also, it makes me think of the fact that we're, and this is something that came up in our interview with Hamid Sino, which was a realization of how enmeshed we are with the systems in which we live. And so you can, as a drop of water within a vast sea of human experience and the structures that we create, you can have that realization. But if you're in a context where everyone else is not also partaking in some way in that discovery, in that approach, it's so much harder to really stay with it, which is something that, as we mentioned at the end of the podcast, The Way Out is In with Joe Confino and Brother Fabhu, that they talk about, like when you have intentional communities coming together or practices where, I don't know, maybe you go to a meditation practice or it's five rhythms, whatever it is, when there is a community endeavor where you're held within a space with common intention, it becomes so much easier to kind of keep that connection to that realization alive, grounded, and more in your daily life.
And I think that idea of it, making spaces is so important. And again, like, I almost kind of wish we said this at the intro now, like there's going to be some spaces in this because we're, you know, we're not going to cut out those pauses. The pauses aren't cut out. And I think that demonstrates and allows something, right? Yeah. It's like, okay, we're going to ask you a question. And I loved how he put it at the end, right? Because we kind of frame this as a different kind of interview. And he's like, okay, well, the flood of my rote answers are coming in, right? And I'm not going to respond to that, right? I can let it come in and then see what's next. And the capacity to drop down, to consider, to pause, to find a response rather than a reaction, I think he modeled really beautifully in there. And I think that's what this, ideally the spaces you're talking about offer, like just stop with others, drop down, find something, and then come back up. You don't have to force it. You don't have to be reactive. You don't have to answer immediately.
It's like the sort of the choppy waves versus the slower depths. Yeah. You don't have to constantly be on the surface getting hit by all the oncoming water. So we had quite an amazing list of really interesting and varied resources at the end that he mentioned, which would be useful just to kind of tee off here. Do you want to start with the top ones?
Yes. So the ones that he himself mentioned, which also came up, the first one came up in our interview with Brian Solis. Finding Meaning in the Second Half of Life by James Hollis. He also spoke about a blog post by Susan Piver, Getting Things Done by Not Being Mean to Yourself.
Yes. Actually, maybe we need to talk a little bit about that before we go to the other resources.
Yeah.
Because that's really interesting in the fact that, yeah, I mean, I sort of jumped to the resources. Like, yes, let's get them in. But there is something around the fact that we have to be productive all the time and optimize for things and for whom. No? Like,
yes.
And that tension.
And I think that, like, how to get things done without being mean to yourself. And the other thing that he was saying about bringing the challenging parts of yourself along.
With you. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I love that.
And we can get into this, like, I mean, particularly
self-flagellating.
Oh my gosh.
Oh, it's exhausting. Yeah. Not that we know anything about that because we're so in, like, I'm kidding.
Yeah, but the productivity stuff, like, I think I'm really helped by some productivity stuff, right? But there is a kind of unthinkingness behind what productivity is for. And his question towards the end about, you know, what do you want to show up for in itself? Something like that, right? That's not just about finishing the job.
And the assumption, because we don't actually often question the assumption of productivity. It's just, it's assumed, like it's a good thing. And to earn one's place on the earth, which he mentioned at, sort of towards the beginning of the conversation. And it was this weird thing of other conversations I've had with other folks, which is this this idea that we have to somehow earn our place. And I think there's this, I mean, now we're getting into slightly different territory, but this idea of duality between the dominion, like humans and the dominion over the earth, and that in order to kind of maintain that hierarchy, something has to be done versus being of the earth, one with the earth, belonging to the earth, which implies an inherent kinship, which means that you don't have to be other than you are.
Doing two all the time.
Doing two. Right? Yeah, doing you can yourself, be stewards of, others, but it's a totally different framing, which was not made necessarily explicit through the conversation, but I think was present nonetheless.
I think we really need, and this comes up again in lots of the conversations, we really need to dig deep into ourselves to understand where the voices are coming from that motivate us, right? Because one of those voices is always the superego voice, right? And this is a swallowed whole conception of our parents' expectations or our social expectations or whatever. That's this thing that, depending on your version, right? Yeah. It's almost always pernicious. It's almost always a bit too much. It's almost always conditional, right? You must, you must, you must, you haven't, that's bad. You know, very judgy. And another voice that is about how you express freely your personal expression in the world. And you do actually, you do need some superego motivation, right? Because sometimes you really do need to pull yourself out of bed, and sometimes you really do need to get your shit together, right? Like, but it's really that balance of like how you supportively push yourself forward, but you're pushing yourself forward listening to a very individual idiosyncratic expression that, that you need to have in the world rather than what you should be doing.
Like not chopping off bits to fit into a box that just doesn't work for you.
And identifying when it feels like you've been chopping off bits, right? Because that's what makes a lot of people unhappy, right?
Yeah.
And being like, okay, what's the message of my unhappiness in this moment? What needs to shift?
Actually, speaking of chopping off bits, one thing that I was really touched by was play. How, and you know, and Oliver said something around he didn't know if he was still playing at the age of 10.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking at the age of 10, I was, I mean, also kind of on the periphery of friendship groups. So I think I occupy myself in this way, but playing with music and art, and that when he wanted to go back to his younger self, that maybe it would just be hanging out or like with his son playing with the Lego. And there's something about that as well. How often do you get to just allow yourself to play where it's not serving any other purpose? Like what you were saying, doing the thing for the joy of the thing itself, not because it serves some other goal.
I really love that. And it made me really think about shifting that question that is implicitly a conceptual question. What would you say? Like, I'm your
Yes, what would you communicate?
Yeah, would you communicate? And I thought, my God,
we just assumed.
I would go back and like that frees me up to go back and just hug this kid.
Yeah.
Like this kid was in such pain, just to go and hug this kid would be like little so much one. More than it's going to be all right, Aaron, you know. Just,
yeah.
Just get to be 16. And,
We'll just take the little one out for a walk. And go to the park. And not have to go
demonstrate
back for hours.
Love.
Like, so I think we need to reframe that question.
I think we do. And I think it's not cliche. It is cliche.
Well, we're striving for the pearl within the glam of the cliche.
Yes. You really do. The cliche is accept yourself, love yourself, right?
Mm-hmm.
But the real business is the act of doing that with love, right? Not a yellow post-it note.
Yeah.
Right.
It's the practice of every time the critic comes in, holding it, trying to hold it slightly lighter.
Absolutely.
Or having a conversation with it from a position of the compassionate voice. I don't know if that works. Different people find different
words,
things useful.
Yes. But it brings in the idea also of superior and inferior, mm-hmm. right? Because when you bring in that theory directly, it's a non-judgmental theory. So again, it's like handedness. Your dominant hand, your less dominant hand. You don't judge yourself if your right hand is your less dominant hand, right? I wish I could write better with my right hand. You don't do that.
Mm.
And when you're able to do that with your own capacities, it's less of a hard sell, right?
Yeah.
It's less of a telling off. Just like, well, I'm just not good at Excel, right? I'm not going to have to like berate myself or, you know?
And I think that's also where a good therapist can come in, which is holding the space for those lesser capacities or inferior capacities to make themselves known, because sometimes they're so dominated. Like if I'm thinking about ways in which to communicate feeling or to be in contact with feelings that you've been cut from, in particular, and someone holds a space for you to find like first one tiny thread of connection, then you're like, maybe I feel this, and then to strengthen that weave and to until you get to a certain point where you realize that you actually do know what you're feeling and you have names for it. But I think all of these connections require the space for the tender shooting that has to happen, or the tender, you know, the mycelial, like to connect, there needs to be a tenderness to that space that's held.
It's so uncomfortable. Like it's never comfortable when you're giving space to your inferior functioning, right? So you really need to be either in a community with a therapist, with in a safe environment to feel that discomfort.
And to be able to fumble in the dark and know that you're held there. And that it's okay not to know.
Yes.
Which is huge.
Yes. And and in the same, I mean, that one of them is like kind of different parts of your personality and different parts of yourself, and the other part's kind of more functional, like skills and stuff. I used Excel. That's not like, I don't hate the part of myself that can't do Excel.
Well, <that's>
okay. But there is a kid that was really told off for just not doing math right. Like my father used to scream at me because I couldn't do this like long division, right? Yeah. So it became a thing, right? Yeah. So there's also this thing about how you get support. And now I am going to go into productivity a little bit because the way my mind has worked is really messy, right? Mm. So I find it really hard to project manage. I find it hard to do all sorts of things. So some of the tools are really helpful. And actually one that he didn't mention, which is the opposite of Susan Piper's in a way, getting things done by not being mean to yourself. It's not getting things done by being mean to yourself. But David Allen's book, Getting Things Done, for me has been one of the most helpful self-help books I've ever read because I need systems and it gave me a system.
Yeah.
Right. Might not work for everyone, but my messy mind needed that particular system. And if you can integrate a system that helps you without the super egoic must.
And it can reduce the judgment sometimes, because sometimes you're just trying to reduce the inner anxiety.
Yes. I didn't know how to do that.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Or it's my fault that I don't know how to do this and how terrible I am that I'm not able to do things that other people seemingly are able to do.
Yes, exactly. And to be with people who have complementary skills for you, right? So someone you can do that with you or do that for you, and you can go back and forth.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So other resources that we'll also mention, include already free Buddhism Meets Psychotherapy on the Path of Liberation by Bruce Tift. I mentioned The Way Out is In with Brother Faphu and Joe Confino. You mentioned Alan Watts.
Yeah. I mean, some of you may be familiar with that. When I watch an Alan Watts video on YouTube or when I listen to it, there's lots of podcasts out there. He has a capacity to almost immediately calm me.
Me too.
Yeah.
It's like a rabbit getting stroked on the forehead.
It's so great. He really just puts you in a place of having all of this noise reduced. So just have a look around YouTube. There's some great videos of him, some great animations with his lovely voice behind to listen to. A really great book to read about him in this kind of paradoxical mystery of the self is called The Book on the Taboo Against Knowing Who You Are. His very small book, Still the Mind. I still think it's one of the best meditation books ever. It's like 70 pages. He doesn't even really tell you how to meditate in there until the very end. But reading it, you're just like, oh my God, I've been meditating. So check him out.
Yeah.
And the last one, for those of you who are really interested in the inferior superior, the original text by Carl Jung's Psychological Types is really interesting, talks about that right from the horse's mouth. And obviously, there's been a lot of work done in the years after that to develop those ideas of types.
Yeah. So lots to get your teeth stuck into.
Absolutely.
And until the next time, thanks for taking the time to show up.
See you next time.